Welcome. My name is Dr. David Wiles, and I'm an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of California, San Diego in La Jolla, California. And this is an IAS USA module on the use of resistance testing in the management of chronic HCV infection. These are my disclosures as we start this program. So on the outline, today I will be covering several topics. First, we'll start off with a little bit of resistance background and go over some of the terms used in describing resistance. Then we'll do an overview of resistance broken down by different inhibitor classes. Specifically, we'll cover NS3 protease inhibitor resistance and NS5A inhibitor resistance. Then I'll move more into the clinical realm and talk about some of the practical management of resistance in the care of patients, what resistance tests are available, and when they should be used. And then finally, we'll try to integrate everything and talk about some treatment approaches in patients who have resistance identified. Moving on to the next slide, we'll talk about antiviral resistance concepts. So first is a resistant variant, or sometimes called a resistance mutation. This is specifically referring to the amino acid change that causes a phenotypic change in how the virus responds to a drug, or a change in the effective concentration 50%. This is a term for the drug concentration in vitro, which results in a 50% reduction in virus expression when you're using cell culture. And we use this as a surrogate then to measure sensitivity of a virus to a drug, and we can look at changes in the EC50. If the EC50 goes up, that suggests resistance to an inhibitor. Viral fitness is something you'll hear talked about. This essentially can be thought of as the cost that generating a resistance mutation imposes on the virus. In other words, most viruses, when they develop a mutation, they have to pay some price. In other words, they don't replicate as well. And this may be the reason that then resistance mutations are lost once the drug pressure is removed. Resistance barrier really composes a number of different characteristics. One would be the number of nucleotide changes, or the genotypic resistance barrier needed to get a change in amino acids. But it also encompasses other things such as the pharmacokinetics of the drug and pharmacodynamics, how much of the drug reaches the sites we think it needs to be active. And then it depends on the specific drug class as well. Finally, clinical resistance really just means you fail to achieve the desired goal in the patient. In the case of hepatitis C, clinical resistance would really be failure to achieve an SVR12 or a sustained virologic response 3 months after the completion of therapy. And then finally, at the bottom in red, probably the most important concept is that we really expect all direct acting antivirals to have the potential to select for resistance when they're used if the patient doesn't achieve a cure. On the next slide, I'm going to talk about the hepatitis C life cycle and actually compare it a little bit to HIV or hepatitis B. And specifically want to focus on the fact that while hepatitis C has the capacity based on its viral characteristics to develop resistance very rapidly, we don't think there's a mechanism by which those resistance mutations are archived or can be maintained by the virus over very long periods of time. But I will mention there is an exception to that with the NS5A inhibitors. So on the left-hand side, you can see favors resistance. And the key components here are that the hepatitis C virus generates a high number of virions in an infected individual every day, and there's a large amount of turnover. And then it also has a very error-prone RNA polymerase that randomly introduces errors as the virus replicates. And these things combined really make the virus set up to develop resistance. In fact, we believe every possible resistant variant is already generated in an infected person just through the error-prone nature and the high turnover. On the other side, though, for a lack of persistence, the key concept with hepatitis C is it's a single-stranded RNA virus with exclusively cytoplasmic replication. There is no DNA intermediate. It doesn't involve any nuclear portion in the cell's nucleus in its replication cycle. So we don't think there's a strict way for resistance mutations to be so-called archived. And again, this is in contrast to HIV, where we have central memory CD4 cells or latently infected CD4 cells that can harbor resistant virus for decades. And in the case of hepatitis B, we have covalently closed circular DNA, which also persists really for the life of the patient once they're infected. And these potentially could harbor resistance mutations. Again, the last point here in terms of persistence is that with hepatitis C, despite there not being a true way to archive resistance mutations, as I'll show you in data later, NS5A resistance mutations appear to persist for quite a long period of time, despite this lack of an archiving. So on the next slide, I just want to break down the characteristics of HCV antiviral classes, specifically talking about the resistance barrier these different classes pose for the virus. Now, within each class, there are certainly differences among the individual inhibitors. And as a general rule, as we've seen newer generation of compounds come out, particularly with the protease inhibitors and to some extent with NS5A inhibitors, we're starting to see higher resistance barriers with later generation compounds. So first is the NS3 protease inhibitors. These are very potent in terms of their antiviral activity against hepatitis C. Earlier generation compounds tended to be have minimal non-genotype 1 activity, some against genotype 4. Although, again, as we get to later generation compounds such as grazoprevir, you do start to see more of a pan-genotypic profile. The resistance barrier for protease inhibitors is generally low. Again, as we get to later generation compounds such as grazoprevir, one that was recently approved, you do start to see a higher resistance barrier and actually activity against resistant mutants from earlier generation protease inhibitors. NS5B nucleotide inhibitors are clearly the winner in terms of their resistance barrier. These have extremely high barriers to resistance, to the point that you often don't see resistant variants selected, even with patients failing after exposure. Currently, the only approved medication in this class is sofosbuvir. There are anticipated to be other approvals in terms of nucleotide inhibitors for hepatitis C in the coming years. Lastly, to mention here, that they are truly pan-genotypic, with activity that really does not vary across all genotypes 1 through 6. NS5B non-nucleoside inhibitors have a lower resistance barrier. These are active at allosteric sites, so not active at the active site of the NS5B RNA polymerase, which tends to be more polymorphic, meaning they're more variable already. The only inhibitor of this class currently approved is dasatinib, and it's always used in combination with paratopervir and ombitasvir. Finally, the NS5A inhibitors. This class is extremely potent in terms of its antiviral activity against hepatitis C. More pangenotypic, though again, some of the earlier compounds in this class, particularly ladipasvir, does not retain much activity against genotypes 2 and 3, whereas compounds like dacladasvir and elbasvir tend to be more pangenotypic as well as ombitasvir, but still somewhat lesser activity against genotype 3 in particular in select cases. These compounds, despite being very potent, really have a very low barrier to resistance. This is the area now where we worry about baseline resistance in patients who have not been exposed to the drugs yet, also potentially impacting therapy, and we'll talk much more about that as we go through. So now we're going to talk on the next slide about NS3 protease inhibitor resistance. And as the subtitle suggests here, this is really not a major consideration with our current DAA therapies. The next slide says the saving grace with protease inhibitor resistance. This is from data with simeprevir, but this has generally been seen anytime protease inhibitor resistance is selected. Once you remove the drug pressure, if the patient was not cured, in general, over time, we see the resistant variants kind of fade away. In other words, wild-type virus outcompetes and comes back as the majority of the viral quasi-species. And in fact, data here with simeprevir or earlier data with talaprevir were very similar in that they showed over the course of about a year and a half after therapy, the resistant variants generally are completely gone in most patients. You can see the difference here in the two lines. Genotype 1A patients who typically select for an R155K variant tends to be a little more fit, so it does go away slightly at a slower pace than it does in a genotype 1B patient who selects for resistant variants that are somewhat less fit, and so they disappear quicker. But again, overall protease inhibitor variants tend to dissipate fairly quickly after failure with a protease inhibitor-containing regimen. Now, what we don't know for sure is whether retreatment is impacted, even if these resistant variants are not detectable at a population level, say with population sequencing. And so on the next slide, we come to some real-world data that tries to answer this question and does, in fact, suggest that prior PI therapy may affect subsequent HCV therapies if they again contain a protease inhibitor. So this is from the HCV Target Network. That is a real-world cohort of patients treated for hepatitis C. And what this looked at was comparing patients who were retreated with sofosbuvir plus simeprevir, so an NS5B nucleotide plus a protease inhibitor with or without ribavirin. And they characterized the patients, these were all patients who had failed therapy previously before they were retreated, and they split them up into those who'd failed previously with just interferon and ribavirin, and those who had failed with interferon ribavirin plus a protease inhibitor. And what you can see on the right is those who had previously failed with a protease inhibitor, when they were retreated with a protease inhibitor containing interferon-free regimen, had a lower SVR rate of 78% compared to those who had previously failed but had not been exposed to a protease inhibitor. Now, there are a couple of caveats to this data. First, resistance testing was not routinely used, so we don't know whether these patients who had prior PI failure going in had detectable PI resistance. Another important factor is it was not clear from the presentation how long after their prior PR failure with an interferon-based regimen were they retreated. And as I showed you on the previous slide, you might expect if it had been 2 years or longer, you would expect the vast majority not to have resistance mutations that were detectable anyway going into therapy. And finally, in a multivariate analysis, prior PI failure was associated with a lower SVR rate, and you can see the odds ratio here of 0.4. So I think this data suggests that prior PI failure may have an impact on subsequent regimens, but again, without resistance testing, we can't tell for sure whether that would have been helpful in deciding who could have been retreated and who would have needed a class switch during retreatment. So another issue with protease inhibitor resistance is shown on the next slide, and that is of the Q80K polymorphism. So this is a prevalent resistance polymorphism. It's found only in genotype 1A patients, but is found in 30 to 50% of patients with genotype 1, particularly in North America. And it does have some impact on the activity of semaprevir as well as other protease inhibitors. So this study was the Optimus study. This looked at sofosbuvir plus semaprevir therapy. Optimus 1 was conducted in non-cirrhotic patients. Optimus 2 was in cirrhotic patients. And a little bit more background here, when semaprevir was used with pegylated interferon and ribavirin, the baseline presence of a Q80K in studies indicated that there was no additional benefit to adding semaprevir if the Q80K was present. In other words, you had similar responses as pegylated interferon plus ribavirin with placebo if the Q80K was present. And so when semaprevir was first approved, the package insert recommended doing a baseline Q80K resistance screen and if found, suggested alternative therapies. But again, the question here is, does that still play a role when you're using sofosbuvir plus semaprevir therapy? So on the left, you can see an Optimus 1 in a non-cirrhotic population. When they're treated for 12 weeks with this regimen without ribavirin, the Q80K has no impact on response rates, 97% versus 96%. Now you can see if you shorten therapy with this regimen, you do start to see an impact, although overall, 8 weeks with this regimen did not look favorable, and it's not recommended to use that. On the right-hand side, you can see in the Optimus 2 study, here we start to see an impact of the Q80K on patients with cirrhosis treated with sofosbuvir plus semaprevir, no ribavirin for 12 weeks. I think there are a couple important caveats here, though, the biggest one being that 12 weeks of this regimen is not what is recommended for cirrhotic patients. So the recommended approach would be 24 weeks, and we really have no data to say whether the Q80K has an impact there. So if we kind of summarize NS3 resistance testing and where does it fit in, significant baseline NS3 resistance associated variants are rare, so there is no routine need for baseline resistance testing. And part of this falls on the next point, which is because the Q80K has no impact on sofosbuvir plus semaprevir when used at approved durations, in other words, when used for 12 weeks in non-cirrhotic patients, we don't need to do baseline testing. Again, as I pointed out on the previous slide, data is lacking with 24 weeks in cirrhotic patients, so we really don't know there, although that regimen is not frequently used just due to cost constraints. Finally, I think that maybe the most compelling reason that we don't do NS3 resistance testing in general is we have lots of well-studied non-PI-containing regimens that are available. So if you have somebody who previously failed a PI plus pegylated interferon and ribavirin, we have lots of good data from phase 3 studies that included a high proportion of patients treated that using a nucleotide plus an NS5A inhibitor works very well in those patients. If you do need to use an NS3 PI soon after failure, we don't have a lot of data. There was an interesting abstract from Cornell that looked at using resistance testing. This was a HIV co-infected population. These patients who'd failed PIs previously, they did baseline resistance testing and only considered therapy with sofosbuvir plus semaprevir if patients didn't have resistance. And there, they did very well. So it's suggesting maybe if you do need to use a PI, doing resistance testing, if you don't find any variants, these regimens may work well. And then finally, as we get into the era of triple DAA regimens, which we won't talk much about, but there is some suggestions from early data that the presence of NS3 resistance may not be used to determine the regimen you pick, but rather how long you treat patients. And that'll be an area that will continue to evolve over the next few years. So now we're going to move on to NS5A resistance. And here, this is, as you can see from the subtitle here, this is where it does appear that baseline resistance and selected resistance really do have an impact on responses to DAA therapy. So in an NS5A resistance overview, baseline polymorphisms, first of all, are relatively prevalent. I have here listed about 10%. And if you look into the literature and data, you'll see this number vary quite widely. And that depends on how you define an NS5A resistant variant or a RAV. And I'll try to cover a little bit of this. And they certainly impact responses in select settings. Another issue with NS5A inhibitor resistance is that among our currently available NS5A inhibitors, there is pretty broad cross-resistance. Some of the key sites where cross-resistance occurs are at M28, Q30, L31, and Y93. And then, as I alluded to at the beginning, while we don't think hepatitis C has a way to really archive resistance mutations in a strict sense, data that I'll show you has suggested that NS5A resistant variants actually do persist for quite a long period of time, at least remain enriched for over 2 years in patients who have failed. And then, if you have failed an NS5A inhibitor-based regimen and have selected for resistance, there is data that suggests retreatment with an NS5A-containing regimen is impacted by that selected resistance. So this table shows broad cross-resistance with early-generation NS5A inhibitors. And what you can see on this next slide is that, particularly in genotype 1A, with the currently approved regimens, which are the first four rows, Ladipisvir, Umbitisvir, Dacladisvir, and Elbisvir, Elbisvir being the most recently approved, that we have pretty broad cross-resistance among positions 28, 30, 31, and 93. You notice more red also under 1A than 1B. Again, NS5A resistance really is only clinically relevant in genotype 1A, particularly baseline resistance is not an important factor in genotype 1B. I think the bottom of the slide, though, can be encouraging in that you can see with some of the NS5A inhibitors that are now advanced into phase 3 and phase 2 trials, you see less red, particularly for the last two lines, kind of what I would probably call third generation NS5A inhibitors, the ABT-530 and MK-8408. These NS5A inhibitors, at least based on in vitro data, are very potent even against single resistant mutant NS5A inhibitors that would cause high-level resistance to earlier generation compounds. It remains to be seen in the clinic whether this holds true and they really are valuable tools to use in patients who have previously failed with NS5A resistance, but is encouraging again based on in vitro data. So we'll talk about baseline NS5A resistance on the next slide, and particularly in a study of Sofosbuvir plus Ladipisvir. So this was a deep sequencing analysis of phase 2 and 3 studies with Sof-Ladipisvir. Deep sequencing meaning they were able to go down to a 1% level, and that's what's reported here. NS5A resistance detected at 1% of the viral quasi-species. And so you can see overall about 84% of patients did not have NS5A RAVs, and about 16% had NS5A RAVs. And then outside the pie chart is the SVR rate in those groups, 97% SVR12 in those without RAVs and 93% in those with RAVs at baseline. So a numerical difference. And then you can see in genotype 1A, 96% in those without RAVs, 92% in those with RAVs. And in genotype 1B, maybe a slightly smaller difference, 98% in those without RAVs and 95% in those with RAVs. While in any of these individual cases, it wasn't necessarily a statistically significant difference, you can see the trend is consistent. And in fact, we'll show you more data, but really across almost all studies that have looked at this, patients with baseline NS5A resistance treated with an NS5A inhibitor, you have numerically lower SVR rates, even if they're not statistically significant in an individual trial. And then there was a follow-up data set presented at the recent liver meeting, looking at Sof-Ladipisvir across not just all phase 2 and 3 studies, but looking across the globe really and how this had been used. And you can see here with 12 weeks of therapy with Sof-Ladipisvir in specifically patients with genotype 1A, 98% SVR rate in those without NS5A RAVs and 91% in those with baseline NS5A RAVs. Again, this similar difference. So if we go beyond and look at the impact of baseline NS5A RAVs in patients with cirrhosis, kind of a tougher to treat population, you'll see again that subtype matters, so it really only impacts genotype 1A patients. And then the particular NS5A RAV matters. In this case, we're looking at NS5A RAVs that cause greater than 100-fold loss in activity of Ladipisvir in vitro or a change in activity. So again, on the left side, you can see it broken down by genotype subtype. 98 versus 85% if we confine the analysis to those with the 1A subtype. On the right, though, now if we start to break this down by both treatment status, so treatment naive versus experienced, and by the fold change that the resistant variant causes to Ladipisvir, we'll focus just in on treatment experienced patients with greater than 100-fold shift in Ladipisvir activity based on the RAV that's present. And here you can see it goes down to 67% SVR rate. I will draw your attention to the 15 at the bottom of that bar, meaning only 15 patients were available for analysis in that subgroup. And that's one of the other problems we encounter, is that given that only about 10% of patients have these baseline RAVs, when you try to look at other factors in concert with the baseline RAVs, you get down to very small numbers of patients so we can observe trends, but it's often hard to divine statistical significance with the small numbers. On the next slide, I'm going to talk about impact of baseline RAVs in cirrhotics. now looking at by what their treatment regimen was. And in other words, we want to see, does using a longer treatment regimen or perhaps using ribavirin negate the impact of baseline RAVs? And now we're back to including all RAVs that were present at a 1% level. And what you can see, there are some trends here. I think it's interesting to note that both of the ribavirin omitting arms have somewhat lower SVR rates than those with NS5A RAVs. While the 12 weeks with ribavirin or 24 weeks with ribavirin, you see more comparable numbers between those with and without RAVs. The only group where absolutely no failures were seen and no difference based on baseline RAVs was soft lidipasvir plus ribavirin for 24 weeks. This is actually not a regimen that would be recommended under most circumstances, not recommended in the label as initial therapy, even in treatment experienced cirrhotics. So it is a potential place where you could theoretically alter a regimen to try to account for RAVs at baseline. Now we're going to switch to grazoprevir elbisvir. This is a regimen that was just approved by the FDA at the end of January, and look at the impact of baseline NS5A RAVs in genotype 1A patients with that regimen. Here it's split up by population sequencing, the left set of pie graphs, and on the right side is next generation sequencing with detection of RAVs at a 1% level. EBR RAVs are those NS5A RAVs specifically found in vitro to cause greater than a five-fold shift in the elbisvir EC50, whereas NS5A class RAVs in this case were really any amino acid change at any site that's been associated with resistance to any NS5A inhibitor. In some settings, these are called NS5A RAPs, or resistance-associated polymorphisms. And these are present, obviously, in a much higher percentage of patients. But as the data below shows, looking at class RAVs or RAPs really brings in a lot of patients where it's not clinically significant. So I think the first message from this slide is, what is really meaningful is what's detected by population sequencing. And looking specifically at elbisvir RAVs identifies the most impactful subgroup of patients. And at the bottom, you can see with 12 weeks of grazoprevir elbisvir in genotype 1A patients who are either treatment naive or relapsers, you see with EBR RAVs detected by population sequencing, the SVR rate moves from 98% in those without EBR RAVs down to 58% in those with EBR RAVs. Now, it's a relatively small number of patients, only 24 patients out of over 400, but it does seem to be a pretty large impact. And it was based on this data that the package insert for this combination of grazoprevir elbisvir does recommend baseline NS5A resistance testing in patients who have genotype 1A. And if resistance testing is done and you find these baseline specific EBR RAVs, that you either select a different regimen, or with this regimen, you can go to 16 weeks plus ribavirin and you seem to be able to negate the effect of those baseline RAVs. I'll just summarize some of the other data for NS5A RAVs in grazoprevir elbisvir based regimens. So as we just said, the impact of those RAVs, as you might expect in patients with genotype 1A, has a even more profound effect in treatment experienced patients who were non-responders. So either partial or non-responders treated with just 12 weeks of this regimen. You can see here the response rate goes from 97% in those without RAVs down to 29% in those with RAVs. Again, a relatively small number of patients, though, in that 29%. Extension to 16 or 18 weeks with ribavirin appears to negate the impact of those RAVs. There was 100% SVR essentially in patients with baseline RAVs, although it's a very small number of patients as you start getting down to these subgroups. Baseline RAVs with this regimen, just as other NS5A inhibitors, have no impact in genotype 1B patients. And population sequencing really seems to be sufficient to identify the patients that clinically are going to have a significant impact with baseline NS5A resistance-associated variants. On the next slide, now we'll come to this data that I've alluded to, persistence of selected NS5A resistance. These are patients who had failed a lidipasvir-containing regimen, one that actually contained a protease inhibitor plus a non-nucleoside as well as lidipasvir. So this is not soft lidipasvir data, but still at failure, essentially all patients had NS5A resistance. Many had multiple NS5A resistant variants present. And then they were followed out to over 2 years. At 96 weeks, 86% of the patients still had NS5A resistance detectable. This was at 1% level on deep sequencing. Now, if you have a prior NS5A failure and resistance and you try to retreat these patients with another NS5A containing regimen, those baseline resistant variants have an impact. And that was what was found in this retreatment study with 41 patients. All had failed soft lidipasvir previously, and were retreated with only treatment extension to 24 weeks. Ribavirin was not used. And you can see overall from these 41 patients, 71% SVR was obtained. However, baseline RAVs really discriminated completely patients. So patients without baseline RAVs had 100% SVR on retreatment, while those with baseline NS5A RAVs only had a 60% SVR rate. If you break it down by the specific NS5A RAVs, the Y93 H or N RAV, which is causes a high fold change and is particularly problematic, had the lowest SVR rate at 33% on retreatment. So as we start to summarize, is resistance a unique consideration in DAA failures? Yes, I think it is. First, resistance is frequently selected on failure, and resistance mutations to some DAA classes, specifically NS5A inhibitors, appear to persist for prolonged durations. And then as I just showed you in that last slide, NS5A RAVs at least are associated with retreatment failures if you use another NS5A containing regimen. Now in that study, they essentially got the exact same regimen with only a treatment extension. But the hook is that what we don't know for sure is if you do resistance testing and make selections of retreatment regimens based on the knowledge gained from that resistance testing, do you improve the success of your retreatment regimen? I think it's intuitively makes sense that this would be the case. This is something we're used to doing for other chronic viral infections like HIV. But again, we don't really have the data to indicate that that's the case. There are commercial HCV resistance assays available. They're genotypic resistance tests that then infer a resistance phenotype. And they come in essentially two flavors. One is based on ultra-deep sequencing or next-generation sequencing, and one is a population-based sequencing assay. The assays that are available, there's one from LabCorp Monogram Biosciences. That's the next-generation sequencing or ultra-deep sequencing assay. But what is reported out are resistant variants that are present at 10% detection level. And there are resistance tests for each region, NS3-4, NS5A, and NS5B. Quest Diagnostics also has a genotypic resistance test available. This is the population-based sequencing assay. And again, all three regions are covered. In general, if you're going to send a resistance test, you should check the patient's viral load and make sure it's detectable at a high enough level. Generally, above 1,000 to 2,000 copies is what you're going to need to get a result with these resistance tests. And right now, they're only limited to genotypes 1 and 3. The genotype 3 assays have just recently come online. A couple other important things about ordering this. If you need resistance testing for more than one region, you're going to need to order separate tests. And the cost is about $500 to $700 per region. That's an estimated cost. Depending on the insurance provider, those costs may be significantly lower depending on contract negotiations. But that is a rough estimate. These are just some examples of NS3 resistance testing. This is the LabCorp monogram assay. You can see here the specific drugs are indicated, specific resistance mutations found, and then an interpretation is provided on the far right. These look very similar if you're familiar with HIV resistance tests. Finally, you're also given an indication of the genotype subtype based on the sequencing data. Here are examples of NS5A resistance testing. Again, the same format for the LabCorp monogram, and the Quest assay is a sample is depicted on the right, which is more of just a text readout, but again, with the predicted resistance or detected or not detected. So some other considerations in patients who failed a DAA-based regimen. So was the initial therapy suboptimal or submaximal, I've pointed out here? In other words, was the patient treated according to what the label would have recommended? Did they get the appropriate duration? And was ribavirin used if it should have been or not? Patients who had suboptimal therapy, I think, obviously are easier to retreat if they get an appropriate retreatment. What specific medication classes were used is obviously important as you think about your retreatment strategy. And if you have options that allow you to switch classes, that always is probably the best approach. What stage of liver disease, what other host characteristics that may have been negative predictors do they have? Most of the time we're talking about, are they cirrhotic and did they previously fail a round of therapy? And then finally, any other indications of problems during the prior treatment? Were there signs that adherence was less than optimal for the patient? And then what about significant drug interactions? So use this as an opportunity to review the patient's medication list. I think particularly with some of the NS5A inhibitors, notably of the approved lidipasphere in particular, proton pump inhibitor use can reduce absorption of that compound. And we've seen data again from HCV Target that Nora Tureau presented at ASLD suggesting PPI use may be associated with lower response rates. So always looking at medications and making sure you don't have adverse drug interactions. And then is the patient immunosuppressed post-transplant, HIV? We don't know that those really affect responses, but it's another consideration. So when should you do NS5A resistance testing? In DAA naive patients, baseline testing should be performed prior to the use of grazoprevir, elbisvir, and genotype 1A patients. And again, this is reflected in the FDA label for this combination that was recently approved. If you do baseline resistance testing and don't find resistance, you can use 12 weeks of Grazoprevir Elbisvir without ribavirin. And you can do this in any patient population, those with cirrhosis and those that are treatment experienced. If you find resistance, you should extend to 16 weeks plus ribavirin or use another regimen. And then in DAA experienced patients, I think resistance testing should be done. This is really an opinion at this point. And based on the results, then you would select retreatment approaches. In the next slide here, I've just laid out kind of a framework or a schematic for how to think about this when you have interferon-free DAA failures. I do think we should do resistance testing, probably do NS3 and NS5A resistance testing. And then based on the results of that, you can see here, I kind of lead you down potential pathways to retreat these patients. If you don't have NS5A resistance, I would think retreatment with sofosbuvir is certainly reasonable. Since you're already talking about an interferon-free DAA failure population, currently, I generally default to doing sofosbuvir plus ribavirin and for the longest duration, 24 weeks. If you don't have NS5A resistance and you've also sent NS3 resistance, certainly sofosbuvir plus ribavirin is another option for 24 weeks, but that's going to be more expensive. If you have NS5A resistance in the middle group here, this is where I think it clearly makes sense to go to sofosbuvir plus ribavirin right now, assuming you don't have high-level NS3 resistant mutations. And then finally, if you do have both high-level NS5A and NS3 resistance, this is really where we don't know what to do effectively with these patients. There have been some small abstracts of using, say, paratapivir, ritonavir, and bidisvir, dasatavir plus sofosbuvir. This was a late breaker at ASLD that suggested good retreatment rates in a relatively small number of patients. You could consider a triple regimen with sofosbuvir and dacladasvir, plus ribavirin if you can get it. And then maybe sofosbuvir for 24 weeks with ribavirin. We don't really have the data. We know that using 24 weeks without ribavirin in those with high full-change NS5A RABS is probably not optimal. And then again, we have investigational triple-based regimens that are coming but not available clinically yet. In the last concept, I'm really just going to talk about genotype 3 resistance and its potential impact on responses. So with sofosbuvir times 12 weeks from the ALLY-3 study, it was 54% SVR12 rate in patients with baseline Y93H resistant variants, you can see, but only 13 patients. And then in the ALLY-3 plus study, which added ribavirin or extended treatment to 16 weeks, in a combined analysis, you do see a smaller impact when ribavirin is present, but an impact nonetheless, 93 versus 88%, but only based on one patient failing. The next regimen looked at in genotype 3, SOF plus velpatasvir, which is a next generation NS5A inhibitor. This is a regimen that has completed phase 3 studies. We're expecting FDA approval probably sometime in summer of 2016. And you can see overall this regimen did very well, and even in patients with genotype 3. However, if you did have baseline NS5A RAVs in a genotype 3 population, you do see about a 9% decrease in SVR rate going from 97% to 88%. And particularly with the Y93H, it was an 84% SVR12 rate. And then even with triple-based regimens, you can see a potential impact of NS5A RAVs in the so-called CCREST 1 and 2 studies with a triple-based regimen of Grazoprevir plus a nucleotide inhibitor plus the next generation NS5A MK8408. 45% in patients with baseline RAVs versus 97 without. Now, this was a shorter duration of treatment, and this is where the concept of potentially just extending therapy in these cases may work out pretty well, even if you do have baseline resistance. So to summarize, the NS3 Q80K polymorphism, or RAV, does not appear to impact responses, especially if you're using label-approved durations. NS5A RAVs are really where the most importance clinically is found. Baseline NS5A RAVs do impact treatment responses. I think that's pretty clear and consistent. And I think they really can be viewed as another negative predictor in patients. So should we be doing baseline resistance testing? Well, in genotype 1A patients, if you're going to use Grazoprevir Elbisvir, the label says we should be doing baseline resistance testing, and I think that is appropriate. The question comes up, should you do it for other NS5A containing regimens? And we just don't have as much data indicating what you do with that resistance if you find it. The label for dacladasvir was just updated and again suggests you may consider doing baseline resistance testing, but the difference is that in that label, there's no real guidance on what to do if you find resistance. We have a very clear-cut set of options with Grazoprevir Elbisvir and baseline NS5A resistance in genotype 1A. And then what about other populations, particularly genotype 3? I just showed you the data that suggests baseline NS5A resistance does have an impact. But again, there we really have a dearth of data on what to do if you find that resistance. In other words, how should you alter your treatment approach? It may be that you would just add ribavirin if you were considering not using ribavirin if you find baseline RAVs, but we don't have the data to actually support that approach. But it does make sense based on what we've seen previously and the impact of ribavirin when RAVs are present. And then resistance testing should really be done in all patients failing DAA-based regimens, meaning interferon-free DAA-based regimens. And selecting retreatment approaches based on resistance testing makes sense. I think I've pointed out, though, that we really don't have prospective data that says absolutely that this is the way to go about this. So that's the end of our program. This has been the IAS USA module on the use of resistance testing in the management of chronic HCV infection. I am Dr. David L. Wiles, and thanks for listening.